And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thank you for joining us for the second hour of our show today. In one brief, it was 20 seconds long, 20-second scene of the HBO comedy some years ago, Sex and the City, the show's main character, Carrie Bradshaw, played by Sarah Jessica Parker, takes a seemingly insignificant bite out of a vanilla cupcake from the Magnolia Bakery in New York City. Unbeknownst to the show's cast and its creators, this small indulgence would set off the defining food trend of the modern era, spawning the cupcake boom of the 2000s. And while you remember that, don't you? And while detractors and trend watchers have been predicting the demise of the cupcake era for years now, we keep eating them. The small confections continue to generate customers and revenue. The cupcake trend began almost by accident, a byproduct of too much cake batter and unused muffin tins. But more often than not, food trends do not have such serendipitous origins. Between the hot-headed chefs, the big company boardrooms, dietitians, food writers, daytime television, food TV, hip consumers, there are a lot of people who help deliberately construct the latest in trendy eating. Over the past 20 years, the specialty food market, which we'll hear about in this hour of the show, has become a booming industry, generating an estimated $80 billion a year in revenue. Our guest this hour is David Sacks. David Sacks became fascinated with the concept of food trends, how they start, when he noticed that cupcakes had moved from the children's birthday party to the upscale bridal shower. The freelance journalist, he specializes in business writing and food writing. David set out to find out why and how these certain foods, flavors, and beverages suddenly become hip, hot, whatever you want to call it. His new book is called The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. Explores the various avenues to hipness via food and the food industry behind it. David Sacks, a freelance journalist, as I said, focused on business and food writing. He's written for the Times, New York Times, Bloomberg, Business Week. His previous book, Save the Deli, In Search of Perfect Pastrami, Crusty Rye, and the Heart of the Jewish Delicatessen, that won him a James Beard Award for writing. And he joins us now to talk chia seeds, pork bellies, pork rinds, Greek yogurt, pomegranate juice, anything you want to talk about this hour of the show. David, it's nice to have you on the show with us. Thank you for joining us on Midday.
Great to be here, Dan.
So it was the cupcake that set you on this journey of discovery.
Yeah, I think it was impossible to miss them wherever you lived. And at the time, I was living in Toronto when the cupcake boom really started. And then I lived in New York for a couple of years and moved back here. And they were just inescapable. There would be a cupcake shop, opening up in every kind of neighborhood. Right. At one point or another, you couldn't walk into a bakery or supermarket without coming across half a dozen varieties of cupcakes. You'd see every week a new type of cupcake. Oh, I think I know everything about cupcakes. Really? Have you tried mini cupcakes? Have you tried booze cupcakes? Have you tried
bacon?
Bacon cupcakes? Have you tried savory cupcakes? It just went on and on. And just when you thought that, okay, there can't be any more of this, there's no way that this could reinvent itself, there'd be some other crazy iteration of this trend, the cupcake ATM machine, that would just kind of kick its energy and spread it wider and further. Right. And I think it really, for me, was this interesting thing, because we all know cupcakes. We've all eaten cupcakes at some point of our life, mostly, when we were five at a birthday party. And they were good, and they always have remained, a delicious indulgence. But something happened to it that kind of triggered our collective appetite. I'd say even as a society, but, it's so international now as a world. What was that? What were the forces that drive foods to make them trendy and make all of us kind of want to, plunk down a couple bucks for a cupcake?
Well, could it have been a TV show? The story I described, the Sarah Jessica Parker moment, the cupcake moment on Sex and the City, can you actually trace it back to that?
That is definitely the, you know, the turning point of the cupcake trend. It had been building for a couple years before at Magnolia Bakery and a couple of other bakeries in and around New York, sort of organically. You know, Magnolia Bakery made them almost by accident when they had an extra quantity of batter when they were making a birthday cake. And they were delicious and they did take off. And it was mostly adults eating them. But it was a local phenomenon. It was written up a couple times in the New York Times and maybe some other publications. But, you know, people would line up, but it wasn't a big thing. What the Sex and the City episode did was it gave it a voice, and it suddenly associated the cupcake with that show and everything that show stood for, which was, you know, luxury, single woman, sensuality. I mean, it turned the cupcake from a child's inexpensive birthday treat to a $500 edible shoe. And put in the same league with cosmopolitan martinis and, you know, rabbit vibrators. Right. But there was another cultural phenomenon that happened is that, you know, soon after that episode aired, you had the attacks of September 11th. And the nation as a whole was plunged into this atmosphere of fear and uncertainty, or, you know, recession and war. And in times like that, you know, our appetites and our tastes tend to veer towards things that are comfort. So you had this greater movement of revived comfort food, the kind of hip hamburger places and the, you know, gourmet grilled cheese or the spins on macaroni and cheese. The cupcake fit into that. It was the edible security blanket, so to speak, the Proustian treat of American childhood that, you know, everything was going wrong with the world and everything was really uncertain and, you know, we didn't know how big or how long this war was going to be and what this meant for our civilization. And so you could go and pay $3, line up and pick up this cupcake and take one bite or just hold it in your hand and instantly be transported back to this time and place. Sex and the City was sort of gave it the voice, but, you know, there was that cultural factor behind it that really, really fed it.
Yeah. I also remember cupcake shops opening and then closing. There was only room for so many cupcake shops. I think some have come and gone pretty quickly.
Yeah, listen, with any boom market, you're going to have your early adopters, you're going to have people who overstep their bounds. You know, I think everybody sort of points to the fate of Crumbs, the biggest cupcake chain, the one that, you know, had 50-odd stores at some point and then went public on the NASDAQ exchange and just, I think yesterday or 2 days ago, got delisted for a lack of activity. And
it's, you know,
heading straight towards bankruptcy. And people say, well, that means the cupcake boom's dead. Well, no, not really. It just means that, you know, these people should not have IPO'd and they put on too much debt and, you know, they didn't have the right expansion plans. But Magnolia Bakery is expanding and doing well. There are other cupcake chains doing well. You go to any supermarket and cupcakes are still there. So is it the same boom times as it was in, let's say, 2007? No, of course not. But, you know, that energy can't last. The lasting legacy of the trend and the reason why it's not dead is that there are cupcake shops now all around the world. The cupcake is this known phenomenon and it's become this expectation of what you serve at birthday parties, not just for kids, but adults and weddings and other functions. It hasn't been replaced by regular cake or even gourmet donuts or cronuts, for that example.
David Sachs is our guest. His book is called The Tastemakers, published by Public Affairs. David, what is a specialty food market? I use that term here. I want to make sure we know what we're talking about.
Sure. The specialty food market is, you know, the fancy food market. Places like Dean and DeLuca or D'Agostino's in New York. I'm not sure what the equivalent in Baltimore is, but it's probably, you know, there's probably a number of stores
Whole Foods
is the big one. Yeah. That's the best example. There's probably local ones in Baltimore that are sort of small, family-owned independents that have been around for a number of decades where, you know, when you say you're shopping there, you're like, man, it's going to be really expensive, but they have stuff that nobody else has. They have that tremendous selection of oils and vinegars, you know, the world's greatest produce, all these different cookies and snacks. And so the specialty food market is really kind of the avant-garde of the grocery world, right? It's the polar opposite of Walmart or Costco, where the most exciting, newest flavors are.
Okay. And you've been looking specifically at that market to see how trends develop in that market.
Well, that market is the early adopter of new trends and trends going mainstream. You know, the specialty food market is always differentiating itself from mainstream grocery by offering things that are new and novel and unique. The people who run these markets travel the world, work with importers, work with you know, small companies to find foods that are different and challenging and surprising to their customers, who are, tend to be wealthier and have, you know, an open palate and sort of a desire for something new. And so that's where you'll, you know, the first place people heard about olive oil or balsamic vinegar were specialty markets.
Okay.
Or quinoa chips, for example.
Well, this is something I'm interested in, that distinguishing a trend that develops the way the cupcake did. A cupcake is a great example of serendipity, of a bunch of different factors coming together, as you described it beautifully here. Versus, let's say, another two other pastries I want to bring up, cronuts and Krispy Kremes, okay? Now, Krispy Kremes was a donut that you got in Virginia. It wasn't even in our market here in the Baltimore area in Maryland. I had a friend who used to actually drive someplace over the Maryland-Virginia line somewhere to buy Krispy Kremes, and he brought them back, and they were still warm by the time he got back to Baltimore. I mean, that guy really hit the gas to get back here in time. So, but then suddenly there was Krispy Kremes everywhere, right? Remember that? There were Krispy Kremes all over this region, but that was simply because the company decided to expand here. So that's one way, you know, something gets in the consciousness and everybody says we got to have a Krispy Kreme because they're all over the place suddenly and doing a lot of advertising. The cronut is a completely different story, right? That's something a particular guy in a particular place in the world developed, right?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I had the exact same Krispy Kreme experience. I was going to university in Montreal, and a friend of mine went to a concert in New York State or Ohio and brought them back, and we couldn't get enough of them. And then the next week, somebody else had to drive across the border to go pick up Krispy Kremes. Suddenly, I remember that Krispy Kreme expanded into Canada, and they were going to do so aggressively, and there were hour-long lineups in the suburbs of Toronto at the first location.
Same thing happened here, yeah.
And then within 2 years, they were sort of belly up, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and then the cronut trend of last summer is really, you know, is incredibly interesting, not just because of this great inventive pastry, which is a hybrid between a croissant and a donut, and it's filled with cream, and it's, you know, decadence cubed. But because of the way that trend, even compared to the cupcake trend, spread virally, like a cat joke on the internet. You know, within a week, there were lineups around the block for this thing, and hundreds of blog posts and photos on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and social media talking about the cronut. Articles in every single publication, you know, every NPR show did something on it. I remember
that's right.
All things considered, one day you had Robert Siegel being, what is the cronut? And then the next day you had, you know, Marketplace doing their kind of cronuts are up or whatever.
That's right.
And within a month, you had cronuts in Venezuela and here in Toronto, Canada, cronuts in London and cronuts in Paris. And by the end of the summer, 2 months later, you had cronuts being taken and sort of corporatized by the Dunkin' Donuts chain in South Korea, where at 200 plus locations all around, you know, the South Korean part of the peninsula, there were sort of knockoff cronuts called New York Pie Donuts.
They called them New York Pie Donuts.
Well, because the name cronut was trademarked within a week of its debut. It was so successful.
NYPD, so that, New York Pie Donuts.
Yeah. So that trend, you know, was a great example of something like, it was like the cupcake in the sense that it was a cultural trend. It captured the public's imagination and it became a symbol for something rather than just a desire for this one item. It became a symbol of the viral age of food trends that we're living in. This was kind of the food trend to cap them all off. This was the food trend that says there are no more limits anymore. Geography means nothing. You know, what becomes popular in one part of the world can become a global taste sensation overnight, as this thing has done.
We'll take a break
with
here,
Krispy
David.
Kreme.
David,
yeah.
Oh, did you want to finish with Krispy Kreme?
No. No, that's okay.
All right.
You should never finish your Krispy Kreme.
All right. We need to take a break here. We'll come back and talk some more. David Sacks is our guest. His book is The Tastemakers. why we're crazy for cupcakes but fed up with fondue. A message to our audience now. If you'd like to join this conversation, give us a ring. 410-662-8780. If you're wondering about how a particular food trend started, or why it ended, give us a ring. 866-661-9309 is our toll-free long-distance number. Good from anywhere in the country, you can get a cronut. And what else do we have? Another means of communicating with us is the email, midday@wypr.org, or you can tweet me a question for David Sacks at @MiddayWYPR. In truth, food trends are nothing new. They're a natural byproduct of civilization's evolution from hunter-gatherers, who ate whatever they could track down, to farmers, merchants, and traders, who had some choice in the matter. No one chased a woolly mammoth with a spear because the head of the tribe declared mammoth to be the hot protein in the Paleolithic era. Back then, the paleo diet was the only option. But once we developed the economic means to select from a variety of foods, certain ones inevitably became more popular than others. Food became a fashion item, a status symbol, and a means of exerting power. I'm quoting from David Sacks' enjoyable book, The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. David Sacks, a journalist who specializes in business and food writing, brings those two together here, wondering, how food trends develop, who's behind them. Certainly, David, agriculture is behind this to some degree. Social media now is a new phenomenon that's added to the mix. Let's talk about chefs a little bit, will you? Can you talk about celebrity chefs and food television and their role in this?
Certainly. You know, in the past two decades, I'd say, the role of chef has changed dramatically in terms of their place in our society and their ability to shape what we want to eat. A chef was someone who operated a restaurant 20 years ago. And occasionally they would publish a cookbook, and a few of those cookbooks became popular and influential. I think about Alice Waters' cookbook or Deborah Madison's cookbook, Julia Child, who wasn't a chef, but a cook. Those had influence, but otherwise, they were the people who operated restaurants, and sometimes those restaurants were successful and had an influence, and most of the time they were places where you ate. But with the rise of the food network and the rise of the modern sort of online food media, where it's not just Food and Wine magazine and Saveur magazine and Bon Appetit and your local dining section, but an entire online universe of Eater and Grub Street, local blogs and Twitter feeds and Instagram feeds that focus on food, as well as entertainment shows like Top Chef and Master Chef and I don't even know, something else chef. They became media personalities. They became celebrities in their own right. And because of that, their influence grew tremendously. And so whatever they put on their plate, whatever they were putting out, instantly got attention. You know, the top chefs of Baltimore, I don't know who they are, but tell me a few, Dan. Who's sort of the best renowned top chef in the city?
Oh, I can mention a few. Spike Jurdy, Cindy Wolf, there's a couple right there.
So let's say, Cindy Wolf at her restaurant, I could pretty much guarantee, knowing nothing about Baltimore, that whenever she puts out a new dish or does something new and inventive, within a day it's been written about, it's been photographed, and it's been covered. And the chefs around town know about that. And if it's good and popular, they're integrating it into their menus at their own restaurants that aren't owned by Cindy Wolf, and Cindy Wolf hasn't even worked with those chefs. That's what happens in this day and age. Now, when you take someone like Cindy Wolf and you show them as a national figure, like David Chang of Momofuku in New York, that impact not only happens across the nation, but it happens internationally. So the age of the celebrity chef and the age of cooking as entertainment and chefs as media figures has allowed food trends to proliferate and grow out of the kitchens of these chefs because they have huge mouthpieces now, because what they do has an impact not just from the people who dine at their restaurants, but the people who don't, people everywhere.
David Chang, you mentioned him. He's actually responsible for some specific food trends, is he not?
Yeah, I mean, he had tremendous success early on with a couple dishes at the first Momofuku restaurant, Momofuku Noodle Bar. One was sort of a reinvented fancy fried chicken. The other one was a reinvented bowl of ramen noodle soup. And the third was a sort of Shanghai-style pork bun with a soft steamed outer bun and a slab of pork belly that's been braised, you know, for many hours till it's delicious to the point beyond measure in the middle. And these things not only became calling cards for David Chang, but they became items that you found in restaurants all around the world. A lot of these chefs who started cooking these things had never worked for David Chang and Momofuku, had never even been there in a lot of cases, but had read about it online or had purchased his cookbook or had read an article about it somewhere. And so, you know, they took those influences and they appropriated them into their own kitchen. And as the way that the cronut sort of spread virally, this is how culinary trends in the restaurant world are spreading as well. You know, a chef, you ask a young chef these days who their influences are, and they'll say, oh, Rene Redzepi, you know, the chef at the fancy restaurant Noma in Copenhagen, Ferran Adrià, the Catalan chef who has, you know, wild modernist creations outside of Barcelona, David Chang or Thomas Keller in the United States. You ask those same young chefs if they've been to any of those restaurants. No, of course. But, you know, I've read about them. I've seen photos online. Nice. And so the exchange of ideas is just happening much quicker and much more rapidly, and that's because chefs have been given this podium to be able to do so.
Hey, let me ask you this. Does a food trend have to have a certain level of authenticity for people to grab it? In other words, the public knows that it's not manufactured by Beatrix Corporation or Kraft Foods, that it's the real thing. It's sort of developed organically, so to speak.
I don't think so. I mean, I think maybe in the world of kind of foodies and those who really, you know, consider themselves on the forefront of eating, but for your average person, you know, when the Sriracha chicken sub comes out at Subway or came out as it did this year,
Yeah, that's right.
For many of them, that's the first time they've ever heard of Sriracha. And so, you know, their indulgence in that is linked to Subway. You know, you also have trends that start in the corporate world. You know, think about the Dorito Taco Loco or whatever that monstrosity is from Taco Bell.
I think that's
That was such a wildly successful thing that I think it was like, you know, bumped up the stock earnings of Yum Brands by 20% or something like that.
Okay.
And so, you know, there are trends that work in the that can begin in the corporate world. One of the things that I looked at in the book was the role of McCormick, the Baltimore Spice and Flavor Company, and their annual flavor forecast, which is sort of this predictive list of what flavor combinations will be big in the coming years. And it's done through the company and they use consulting chefs, but they also reflect, you know, what are the spices we have? What do we need to sell? What do we think is going to sell? And then McCormick will take that list of the top 10 flavor combinations and sell it to their customers. So that will be Beatrice and Cisco and McDonald's and Yum Brands and Nabisco and Cadbury's and so on and so forth. And those companies will then go and create products out of that. And some of those products will become successful. And they'll influence other products. And sometimes they'll go back and influence what's happening in the kitchen of interesting independent restaurants. So, you know, trends can come from all different directions. And it's a far less predictable game today than it was, you know, two decades ago.
I just thought of another example, KFC's Double Down. What was that? I don't know how many years ago that was, but it lasted for a few weeks. I don't know if it's still out there. It's the breadless chicken sandwich.
Chicken sandwich that uses chicken as bread and bacon as chicken.
In the middle,
I think it's still out there, yeah. But yeah, exactly. Not only a tremendously successful thing, but something that influenced independent restaurants. So I've seen kind of hipster restaurants here in Toronto make their own version of the Double Down, you know, with artisan chicken breast and, you know, kimchi on it and different flavors. And it's kind of this funny, ironic spin on it. But it was so trendy and successful that it actually goes back up the food chain to the high end.
David Sacks is our guest on Midday. He's talking about his book, The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue, a look at the world of food trends. Carolyn giving us a ring to comment about something related to this. Carolyn, you're on Midday. Go right ahead, please.
Hello. First of all, I'd like to wish David a happy day after Canada Day. I'm originally from Montreal, and yesterday was Canada Day.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Happy national holiday. The Montreal bagel is fantastic. I don't know why no one has franchised that. But originally my comment was, my question is about couscous, because that's, of course, a North African-based durum wheat thing. It cooks up faster than rice. Basically, you boil water, you throw it in, and then you leave it off the stove for 10 minutes. I'm shocked that this has not become more commonplace in the American household, where, of course, we're all about getting it done quickly. It's the ultimate fast food, and we have lots of wheat in this country. And I'm just wondering if you could comment about that, and also avocados. How did this avocado trend start? What's up with the avocados?
Yeah, when you mentioned Subway before, I wanted to mention the avocado thing. I just don't get it. But anyway, what about couscous? I think couscous has become more popular, but that's just based on what I see in the supermarket and my own habits. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Middle Eastern food has been growing. You know, we had kind of that first hummus invasion in the 1990s where there was tons of it. And now there's, you know, dozens of brands of hummus.
Yeah,
but what you're seeing now, for example, nearby in Philadelphia at the restaurant Zahav, is this kind of nouveau Middle Eastern that's now coming back to it. There's having a second wave, and there's more attention being paid to it. It's not just food that, you know, you would have at a terrible, I don't know, John Hopkins like grad dinner, you know, hummus and dip. But there's being serious culinary attention paid to it. The cookbook Jerusalem by the chef, the British Israeli chef Odalenghi, is the best selling cookbook in decades. So you're seeing more interest happening with it at the high end level and the restaurant level, and you'll see more brands using things like couscous and tahini and you know, different Middle Eastern food. So it will come out. It's just also a question of what format, right? It doesn't fit into American fast food or American sort of mainstream dining in any way. Maybe the Cheesecake Factory is going to have, you know, a couscous and tagine or a couscous salad. but it has to come in that way. Caroline, I will say to the point of Montreal bagels, I could almost guarantee you that in the next couple years, you're going to see a bigger national presence. At the beginning of this summer, a good friend of mine named Noah Burnimoff opened up, who owns a Jewish deli in Brooklyn, and is from Montreal originally, opened up a place called Black Seed in Manhattan. And it has been a fantastic, incredible success. It is selling Montreal-style bagels that they make right there in downtown Lower East Side to New York, the bagel city, the city that claims to have bagels all on its own. So they have, you know, plans to sort of grow. And I think there are others in other cities. I think there's a place called Beauties in San Francisco or Berkeley that's doing it. So I do think that the Montreal bagel will be something that will be, thank the Lord, in your grasp.
Can you describe, excuse me, David, I think you better describe it, Montreal bagel, for those of
the
us
Montreal bagel.
Who haven't
the
had
Montreal
the experience.
Bagel, yeah. The Montreal bagel is a hand-rolled bagel that's yeasted and boiled in honey water before it's baked in a wood-fired oven, almost like a pizza. It has a bigger hole and is twisted and is denser than the average sort of New York-style bagel, which is a bit airier and has, you know, is more of like a bun almost. Hmm. And so it's actually closer to the traditional bagels that were brought over from Poland. And once you've had one, you know, you're either in love with them or you'll never eat them again.
Okay.
I personally love them, but my family's from Montreal.
Avocados,
it's a two-pronged trend, right? On the one hand, it comes in this cultural way. And that's, you know, one of the biggest cuisines that's been growing over the past 50 years in the United States is Mexican cuisine. As there's more immigration, as there's more travel to Mexico, as we've moved from, you know, chimichangas and chichis and Taco Bell type Tex-Mex stuff to authentic fresh Mexican and, you know, chains like Chipotle, which are sort of trying to approximate that in a fast way, avocados have become a much more central part of our diet. It's not something that's weird and off-putting. It's something that's very familiar. And the California Avocado Board and the Mexican Avocado Board have grown. And as they've grown, they've gotten tremendous budgets to market and try to get avocados into different places. So the avocados at Subway and the avocados, you know, smeared on a Subway sub, like 9 avocados on a sub, or now avocado as a condiment. You know, that was an initiative that was paid for by the avocado marketing people. And that's the way that the corporate food world can sort of push food trends from the marketing perspective. They can say, look, you know, Burger King, we want to do an avocado chicken club thing. You know, here's, I don't know, $500,000. See if you can develop some recipes and do some test markets. We'll subsidize that for you. Burger King's like, great, we're always looking for something new. And then if it takes off, the avocado people are happy because that, you know, kicks sales of avocados up into the millions more. And so, you know, behind the scenes, there it's not just sort of chefs and the creatives looking to push the food trends. It's the big companies. And avocados is one of those. It's an industry-driven thing.
Something I wanted to discuss with you, maybe you have an example of this, perhaps pork bellies is a food that might have been considered in the past peasant food, something that people just ate because it was available. It wasn't trendy. It wasn't up. There was nothing upscale about it. It wasn't hard to get. It was fairly common. Something like cornmeal. Okay. I'm just more amused by this than anything. Having grown up in an Italian-American household where polenta was served quite frequently because it was cheap and filled you up and tasted good. And to go into an Italian restaurant in the 21st century and have a bronzino con polenta, you know, a nice braised European sea bass with a slice of grilled polenta, grilled, not just mushy polenta, you know, and spend $35 or $40 for the entree. I'm just more amused by that than anything else. But then again, a chef or a restaurant rediscovering something or repackaging it, so to speak, presenting it in a more sophisticated way?
Exactly. And you know, I think we can go back to the cupcake as the best example of it. Because
probably,
the cupcake is, you know, there's no supply and demand with cupcakes, unlike pork belly. you know, the price of cupcakes is not tied to the availability of, like, the cupcake plant that grows in the South Pacific or grows in the land of unicorns, apparently. and yet, you know, as cupcakes became popular, as a food becomes trendy and gains that cultural cachet, our demand for it increases. And as our demand for it increases, our willingness to pay a premium for it does as well. So, you know, it's not unthinkable to pay $5 for a cupcake if it's made in an incredible way, even though the cost of that cupcake might be $1.50. And that's what happens with food trends. They will sort of the demand for a food will swing on a pendulum based on its place in the cultural hierarchy.
David Sachs is our guest here on Midday. We'll take another short break and come back and speak with the business and food writer and author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue, a look at how certain food items become suddenly hip and then also suddenly disappear. I'll have to ask David about that too. If you have a question or a comment for David Sachs about food trends, 410-662-8780, toll-free long distance 866-661-9309. Send us a question by email or comment by email, midday@wypr.org. I got a bag of chia seeds at home. I have no idea what to do with them. My son bought them. Quinoa? Quinoa. I know it's quinoa. I'm just kidding you. It just showed up one day. So what am I supposed to do with this? Dad, have you had quinoa? No. What is quinoa? Where did this come from? How much did this cost? Pork rinds, I got no problem with. George H.W. Bush ate pork rinds. And back during the, what diet was that? David, what diet was that? The Atkins diet?
Atkins.
Yeah. The Atkins said it made it okay to eat pork rinds, right?
Right. Yeah. That was the theory of that day, which you know, the health and diet trends are just, I mean, they're laughable. I really do find them laughable because, you know, everybody's so convinced about the rightness of what they're doing right now. I'm on the paleo diet. I'm eating gluten free,
exactly.
Even though I don't have celiac disease. I'm macrobiotic. I'm whatever. And then you ask them 5 years later, hey, you still on that thing? Oh, no. That's been disproven.
Didn't work for me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, exactly. It didn't work for me. But it's a great excuse to go buy, you know, Cheerios fortified with quinoa or whatever it
is. Well, can we talk just a little bit about chia seeds and quinoa?
Quinoa. Let's just call it
quinoa. Okay, so where did this come from? How did this become a trend?
You know, I think there's been this larger trend towards what are called ancient grains or a rediscovery of different plants that have certain health properties. And as different diet trends come into vogue, whether it's a low-fat trend or a high-protein trend or, you know, the craze about antioxidants that's fed by people like Dr. Oz, you know, people in the food world go looking for things that fit that profile. And so quinoa and chia are two South American grains that, or I don't even think quinoa is a grain, but you know they're two South American plant products that sort of fit into that. They hit different checklists. They have you know high in vitamins, high in protein, high in antioxidant, gluten free. And so if you're selling food, you can put those into your products and sell them to a large number of people and charge more for it. You sprinkle a little chia dust on it, you sprinkle a little quinoa dust on it, and people will pay for it because it makes them feel virtuous about what they're eating. You know, quinoa, you can actually cook and eat it almost like couscous, actually. You can consume on its own. Chia seeds are just a tasteless thing that is better added to other products. So quinoa you can just have directly, but chia seeds, you know, you would add to other things. And so these things, you know, they surf the wave of different health and diet trends that are popular at the time, and their fortunes rise and fall with those trends.
David Sachs is our guest on Midday this hour. His book is The Tastemakers: Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. We need to get to the fed up part with food trends at some point here before our hour ends. But Kurt is calling from Bel Air, and he has a question that I was going to ask David. I'll let Kurt ask it. Go right ahead. Hi, Kurt.
Hello, David. Hey, I'm a chef and food blogger, and I'm really curious about this kale thing and how it got started. I mean, why not Swiss chard?
How did kale?
That's a good question. Why not Swiss chard? Poor Swiss chard. Didn't even have a chance. It's interesting. I think the kale thing is fundamentally, you know, there's a cultural trend behind it. I was on a NPR show the other day in Boston, and a guy called in from Vermont and said he invented the I Heart Kale bumper sticker, or the Eat More Kale T-shirt, and he claims credit for making it this kind of cultural thing, which is true. It became this Prius of the vegetable world where it's like, I eat kale. I eat kale and I voted for Al Gore. What did you do for America today? But it also has a practical thing. And I think that gets down to kind of its place in the vegetable drawer. You think about something like Swiss chard or even spinach, which it really replaced. Kale is a hearty, hearty vegetable. It can grow in almost any condition. It can stay good in the refrigerator for 2 to 3 weeks. It does not spoil very easily. And when you put it in a pan and expose it to heat, it doesn't just shrink and wilt away. You can use it in salads. You can use it raw, or you can use it cooked. You could bake it. You could fry it. You could grill it. You can kind of do anything with it. It's the Swiss Army knife of leafy greens. And as a chef, I'm sure you appreciate that. I mean, if you're looking for something that's going to give you bang for buck for your food cost, having a bunch of kale in your kitchen, you could put it into 5 different dishes, and you know it's not going to be wasted and spoil if it doesn't sell in a day or two. It's going to be fine. It's going to hold up really well. So I think at the core of the kale thing, all that virtuousness, the health, the, you know, cultural ideal behind it, is the fact that it's just a really practical vegetable. I had some kale for lunch. It had been sitting in my fridge for a couple days that my wife had brought back.
Oh, it keeps.
It keeps, right? Yeah. And I was just like, all right, what am I going to do? I'll just fry it and throw it on top of this egg salad sandwich I'm going to have. And it worked, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas if that had been spinach, it'd just be like a ball of slime after a couple days. Fundamentally, these foods that sort of remain trendy, they do so for a reason. Cupcakes are really easy to make. You know, they're really, really simple. If it was like some fancy French quenelle or something else like that, you know, you don't see it as much. Soufflés did not become the big dessert trend of a couple of years ago.
I'm not surprised you got that call from Vermont about the kale. My son was in Burlington, kind of a crunchy city, and and uh, a guy, a panhandler, came up to him and said, "Hey, buddy, you got a dollar for a veggie burrito?" That's your Vermont panhandler. And I didn't make that up. I didn't make that up either. Yeah, it seems like health drives a lot of this. Kale is considered a superfood, right? It's in that superfood category. I have a daughter who puts it in a blender and makes a smoothie with it, you know?
Yeah, and that superfood category is, I mean, you might as well say it's unicorn dust. It's the most meaningless term. The European Union has actually outlawed the term superfood as just a form of false advertising. Yeah, anything's a superfood. What'd you have for lunch today?
Blueberries. Blueberries are a superfood.
You had blueberries for lunch?
I had salmon skin. Isn't that?
See, there you go. Salmon skin's high in omega-3s, and that's a superfood. This is a superfood. That's a superfood. Right. It's being used to market things. You know, there's a product a couple of years ago called 7-Up Antioxidant Berry, which was 7-Up with a drop of, you know, acai berry or cherry juice in it or blueberry juice in it. You see this all the time, and they're saying, well, it has the power of superfoods. It's pixie dust. It's snake oil.
It's Oz. It's from Dr. Oz, right?
Yeah, the Wizard of Oz himself, you know, who you saw torn apart in front of Congress last week for, you know, essentially pushing things as miracle cures. You know, you're going to eat turmeric and it's going to cure your cancer. No, it's not. If this was the case, if all we needed to do to live longer was eat a bunch of blueberries, we would have been, you know, living forever 150 years ago. Everything works in moderation and all these foods have benefits. But, you know, is eating a diet rich in kale healthier than eating a diet rich in chard because it has X percentage more nutrients or antioxidants? Nobody knows that, and I highly doubt it if it is.
Hey, David Sachs, I've mentioned Greek yogurt here a couple of times and wanted to ask you specifically about that because I was kind of fascinated by the Greek yogurt thing because we've had, you know, decades of Danone in the United States and not much more than that. I mean, some other brands, obviously. But then suddenly the Greek yogurt shows up, and it's more expensive, it's thicker, and people are talking about it. People are talking about it's higher quality, it's healthier, something like that. All I know is it's more expensive and thicker. So where did that come from? Greece?
Well, yeah, like the sprung from the belly of the Trojan horse itself and took over the dairy case in the span of a couple of years. You know, I bring it back. It's sort of like the kale thing. For all the furor over Greek yogurt and all the, you know, insanity of Greek yogurt-coated chocolate bars and Greek yogurt, you know, frozen yogurt at Ben & Jerry's, fundamentally it provided a better product than what yogurt had become, which was largely, you know, some sort of like oversweetened, overflavored dessert in the true American way, you know, a diabetes delivery system of, you know, drinkable cappuccino flavored yogurt in a straw. What I recall from the first time I bought a tub of plain flavored Greek yogurt back in 2008 when I moved to New York was that this stuff was thicker and richer than any other yogurt I'd ever had. And it was amazing. I could use it to bake with. I could use it in desserts. I could use it almost like ice cream. I could use it for breakfast. But I could also, you know, stir it into a sauce or a pasta or something and give that weight. It could go in all these different directions. And so I think it kind of worked its way in there that this was something that was better. Health people liked it because it was higher in protein and lower in fat. People who were in the chef's culinary world liked it because they could do all sorts of things with it. And then, you know, the business of food liked it because it was exciting. People were into it and they could do anything with it. They could put it into all sorts of products so they could just kind of paint something in quote unquote Greek yogurt and sell it for more money, like honey nut bunches of oats with Greek yogurt. And so it took off on its own momentum. But what you're seeing now is Greek yogurt's gone so far and become also so flavored, so sugary, so diluted from what it originally was that you'll see a reset. You'll see people selling Australian yogurt or Lebanese kefir. Seriously. Yeah. I mean, I was at the Fancy Food Show 2 days ago on Monday, which is the big industry trade fair for specialty food, like we talked about, you know, the sort of cutting edge of where the grocery world's going. And I was there 2 years ago when I was writing about it for the book, and I saw all these Greek yogurt brands and Greek yogurt companies and products with Greek yogurt in them. The only place I saw Greek yogurt on Monday at that fancy food show amongst thousands and thousands of vendors was in the Greek national pavilion of one company trying to sell it. So, you know, that's what happens to trends. They go through that cycle and their excitement gets turn into all sorts of different products, but it runs out of energy. Right. There's nowhere it can go.
So is that what happened to fondue? We're getting toward the tail end of our talk together here. So the tail end of your subtitle, why we're crazy for cupcakes but fed up with fondue, raises that question. What happens to something that seems to be very popular and everybody's consuming it for a while and then it disappears?
Yeah, I mean, fondue is a great example because it's such a dramatic thing. And it, you know, once upon a time, people socialized at fondue parties. It was a thing that you did. And while people still make fondue and people still enjoy it, you know, what was the last time any of your listeners went to a fondue party in Baltimore or in suburbs?
We need to have one. We need to have a fondue party and play Twister afterwards, you know?
Exactly. What was it? I mean, there were the factors. There were the diet and health factors, right?
Yep.
The low-fat craze came in and the low-carb craze came in. And, you know, fondue is a bunch of carbs dipped in fat. So it doesn't really...
Sometimes
doesn't
Velveeta.
Really
Velveeta, if you're not careful.
Doesn't really help out. And then there were other cultural factors. You know, the rise of HIV and AIDS put an end to a lot of that sort of free love, communal eating, sharing that the fondue party was part of. Fondue parties were really a sensualized thing that grew in concert with the rise of the pill and the sexual revolution.
That's why Twister worked so well at fondue parties.
That's exactly, nobody was playing Monopoly, God. And so, you know, that was the end of it. But of course, you'll see it come back in different ways and shapes and forms as people crave those things in the society. As we share things more, as we're more interested in that sort of culture, those sorts of flavors, someone will reinvent fondue. And next thing you know, we'll be breaking out the Twister sets again.
I bet you're right. David, this has been fun. I've enjoyed talking with you about this, and we really have enjoyed your book. I just wonder if you had one trend for us to watch for? Something you see on the horizon?
You know, there's the rise of kind of fast food mainstream Indian food in North America. Yeah. You know, you've seen it with Mexican food over the years. You've seen it with Middle Eastern food and things like falafel and hummus. And Indian food's been trying to do it for a while. And there's a number of entrepreneurs around the country that have been trying to make Indian food mainstream, make it something you'd find in a food court. I think there's a guy in Baltimore actually who has a place called Crazy Kebab, maybe out by the university. And he's been, you know, working to do that, kind of a mashup of Indian and Mexican. Hmm. And so I think that's something that we'll see in the next couple of years, I'm hoping at least.
Well, thank you very much, David. I really did enjoy our conversation. And congratulations on this fun book, an interesting book. David Sachs's book is The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue, Public Affairs is the publisher. Thank you, David.
My pleasure, Dan.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to Midday Today. We want to thank and extend good wishes to Midday producer Jonathan Ahrens. He's leaving us today for another public radio job in another East Coast city. John, good luck. And as Garrison Keillor says, do good work and keep in touch. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to Midday for today. Have an enjoyable afternoon, and we'll see you again soon, like real soon, like 22 hours from now or so, for another edition of Midday.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, and Anna Muckerman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.